Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Well, today's topic, from a suggestion, is the topic of reasoned conviction or faith or confidence, whichever word you want to use. The Pali word for this is saddha, and we have, of course, the word is very used a lot in English: faith, confidence, conviction. But its definition will be very much conditioned by the Christian influence of the West, and the particular way it's used. And of course, there's all kinds of confidence and faith. You're confident of an idea, you're confident that a plan will work. You're self-confident. What are these? These all have different resonances. And when this is from the Buddhist perspective, the Buddha talks about this as a faculty. You have the faculty of confidence. And the confidence there, there's again several kinds of confidence. Confidence in the teaching of the Buddha. Confidence in yourself that you are able to undertake the teachings, that you are able to benefit from the teachings, that you are able to practice the teachings, sometimes also that you are able to teach the teachings. Overarching confidence that the teachings work. And then there's confidence in the teacher, that is the Buddha himself, whether he was accurate and competent in his descriptions. And so that's a faculty. It occurs in conjunction with four other faculties. This little grouping is very, very well known and very important, called the five faculties, and also called five indriya. As five faculties, they're listed as saddha, the faith, confidence; virya, energy; sati, you all know that one, mindfulness, right in the center; and then concentration or samadhi; and the last, but far from least, panya, or wisdom. Confidence, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. These are the five faculties. And the order is not haphazard. There is a reason for the order. One thing you'll come to appreciate in looking over the teachings of the historical Buddha is that they're incredibly systematic. Nothing is casual. The more you look at them, there's a very precise and lucid reason for everything he says and how he says it and in what order he says it. It doesn't mean that everything goes only in one direction, one order, but when he gives a list, it's usually not a casual jumble of ideas. So when you look at these five faculties, you notice that confidence, faith, is on one end, it's number one, and on the other end, the faculty of wisdom. And then the next two on the inside of those bookends, the bookends, confidence on one side, wisdom on the other. Numbers two and four are energy and concentration. So these come in two pairs, and in the center, mindfulness. Mindfulness in a sense, acts as the reporter and sentry and monitor of the balance between the other two pairs. So your clarity tells you when energy is becoming excessive and turning not into the wholesome, but into agitation. It's becoming excessive, and what will suffer is concentration, its partner. So mindfulness reports this, and then wisdom will make some adjustments. Wisdom tells you that you should increase your concentration, you should shift to a more serene type of topic, do something that releases the agitation and bring you back into balance with concentration, so that you have energy, but it is not manic energy. It is properly flowing energy. It's like putting too much energy through a hose. There's a proper flow. Beyond that, it gets chaotic. Energy patterns get chaotic. Concentration the danger of concentration is that if it doesn't get enough energy flow to it, it will drop below real concentration into drowsiness or blankness, the absence of things. It could be all the way to unpleasant sense of sloth. You know. The simile for it, of course, is water when there's slime and things growing on the surface of the water. It doesn't have enough motion in it. It doesn't have enough energy in the system. If you have these little aquariums, you know, they always have an oxygen pump in them. That's what keeps them alive and oxygenated. So energy, mindfulness is balancing between energy and concentration. It keeps concentration up. And wisdom and faith are in balance too. Faith, when it is a very dominant characteristic of a person, they tend to, without question, naively believe things without reflection. They tend to be gullible. Sometimes they believe inaccurate reports, and sometimes they believe in false ideas. But what they do have in spades is the capacity to believe. On the other hand, wisdom is the capacity to sort through things, sort through a whole bunch of different ideas, sorting and to give sort of both sides of the question on all kinds of situations. And some people have this in spades. They tend to get, if you have that in excess, you tend to get this very uncomfortable experience of never being able to come to the end of your thinking process, never being able to have a sense of resolution. Thinking doesn't go anywhere. It's done for its own sake. Thinking for its own sake. It's a little bit gone out of control. And it because it can see so many sides of the issue, it tends to get paralyzed as well. In its kind of pathological condition, it's called permanent skepticism. A very uncomfortable experience to be skeptical of everything. It's also rather uncomfortable to be with a person who is skeptical about everything. They can't stop questioning everything. They can't come to the end of the resolutions. They don't seem to be able to take the sword of wisdom and just cut the issue. Sometimes you have to do that. You can't just be unraveling knots endlessly. Well, you remember the story of Alexander the Great, the young fellow who managed to conquer the known world by the time he was 28 years old. And he was taken to the cave where they have the Gordian knot. It's this knot of infinite complexity hanging from the ceiling of a cave. It's like 10 feet long. And nobody had ever been able to unravel it. It was a great puzzle. So and he wanted to go see this, so he was taken there. But so obviously a direct man of action, he managed to, you know, conquer the known world. But he was dead by 28. So you still, you know this name, Alexander the Great, so 23, 24 centuries later, you still know of him. So anyway, when he went in there to look at the Gordian knot, he just took out his sword and cut the thing in half. He said, "What are you, you know, what's the problem here? Is untie this thing, you just cut it." You know, very embodying this kind of direct. And wisdom is often symbolized as a sword, a thing that cuts through things. But as you know, when you're in the kitchen, if you mishandle a knife, you can cut yourself with it. It also can be, there's a limit to how much you cut, even in the kitchen. We had a fellow at our monastery at one period of time who was not well balanced. And he was helping prepare food, and somebody came to me and said, so-and-so's been in the kitchen, you know, and he's been cutting the same carrot for the last half hour. So, well, he had to go and get rebalanced somewhere. There's a limit as to know how many pieces to cut, you know. There are all kinds of skillful, beautiful ways of cutting up a carrot. But there's also a balance about when it is cut. It is finished. The cutting is finished. So wisdom is can become pathological if it doesn't have a balance. And mere faith also can be naive and can be problematic if it believes everything. And these two are to be balanced together. And mindfulness has to be able to sense, intuit, when one is out of balance. So the Buddha doesn't insist that, in terms of his teaching, it's blind faith, that there is no evidence ahead of time. Everything has to be taken on blind faith. And that only, say, after you die, will you know, will your faith be gratified. Maybe like, let's say, a UFO cult, you know, that the leader says that a spaceship is going to come and take everybody to paradise. In the meantime, you just have to believe that it's going to arrive at such and such a date. And in the meantime, you just have to believe me. And before that, there's going to be no evidence one way or the other about this matter. Sorry, that's just the way it is. So any kind of trying to figure out whether it's true or not is going to be futile. That would be a case where it would call for blind faith. And some religions are like that. They call for blind faith where there isn't, you're not going to get any way of evaluating the truth claims ahead of time. There's no experiential possibility for it. So the teaching of the Buddha is not that way. He says you may not be able to examine 100% of the teachings in all directions. In other words, you may not be able to confirm the teaching of, you know, the totality of karma into the infinite past. But you will certainly see aspects of it, parts of it. There should be, it's open for experiential confirmation. So in a sense, the Buddha says, you know, these things are to be tried. This is an experience, an experiment in reduction of suffering. Here are some techniques. Here are some methods. Go ahead, try it. I'm not asking you to accept in entirety everything I say. Although, and this is often the case when people, especially in the West, they tend to claim that the Buddha taught that you should not believe anybody any authority about anything, or that you should not try, not take any of the Buddhist teachings on faith. Yeah, of course he didn't say that. That would have been saying that you can't trust me at all. I may be telling you anything. You'll just have to, you know, sort of go cautiously with this, and maybe it'll work out, but you'll have to know for yourself. No, he said again and again and again, what I say is absolutely true. There is no doubt whatsoever. My vision is absolutely clear. You can trust it 100%. I do not make a mistake. There is no mistake in this. Whoever trusts me and acts on this will have the results, good results. He says that again and again. But he says, that is not, of course, how I approach people who do not trust me yet. And so there's a sutta called the Kalama Sutta, the teaching to the Kalamas, this group of people, there was a lot of people coming through that area, a lot of different spiritual teachers. And they were open-minded people, and they were interested in different spiritual teachings. And so that when they came to the Buddha, they said, well, how should we evaluate teachings, like your teachings and other teachings? So the presentation to the Kalamas, which is one very famous and often quoted, especially in the West, is not to do with the notion that you should doubt everything. It is how the Buddha would skillfully teach people who have no particular reason for believing him or faith in him. He said, you know, how would you approach sorting through various teachings? There's lots of teachings out there. Well, first you would evaluate. My approach would be this, and let me see if it resonates with you. Is that first of all, I would say, does the teaching, do they advocate hatred or non-hatred? Then he asks, is, in your experience, is hatred a profitable thing? Do you like it? When you're on the receiving end of it, how do you feel? When you're on the giving end of it, how do you feel afterwards when your mind clears up? And they, being fairly reasonable people, tend to agree with him on this point. Say, yeah, hatred is not good. Non-hatred is better. Some version all the way from neutrality to positive loving kindness, that we can agree on. He's not asking them to agree on anything that's out of their experience. He's asking them, from your own experience, which one is preferable, hatred or non-hatred? And he says, how about greed? When somebody's, you know, accumulating everything and obsessive and holding on, does that strike you as, you know, pleasant to live with, good experience? Or how about generosity versus generosity? Do you prefer moods of generosity yourself, and when other people are generous and so forth, is that you feel that's good? And do you find that praised by the wise? You know, from your own experience? And they say, yeah, of course, we agree. And then delusion, you know, somebody who's utterly muddled and unclear about the nature of what's real and what's not, versus non-delusion, etc. So he asked them just on their own experience about these things that they have had some experience with, and how would you evaluate that as positives? And so he says, well, this is... So, you know, the reasonable person says, yes, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. And that's what, you know, what I'm teaching, advocating, is non-hatred, not manifesting it in actions or in speech or in thought and so forth. This I find good. That's something you can confirm here and now. It's not something you find out after death or some other time, or you can only find out through a special revelation from God or through a prophet or something like that. You can find that out directly. You can see. And notice one thing in the Kalama Sutta, the phrase praised by the wise. He's also not putting this out of the possibility that you have a sense that there are wise people in the world that seem to have opinions that are of value about things. They they say, how do you know that, you know, that's one of the indications of a person's wise is they say certain effects will follow these actions. And it turns out that is correct. If you do this, this will happen. Now, how do they know? This is when you're, like your parents sometimes tell you this. You know, if you do that, if you say that to that person, this will happen. And then you're wondering, wow, I wonder how they know that. You know, I never thought of that. Now, if you hit that little boy, no one will like you. And he might hit you back. Really? That never occurred to me, you know. As a kind of beyond, and so you start to, they seem to know, you know, like, watch out here, you know, you go, make sure you go over there and ask that person that. You have no idea how they can know this, but it seems they have a much broader notion of how the world works. So there are people like that seem to know these things. So there is a sense, he is appealing to the sense that he's not going at this in a completely skeptical, philosophical way, is he? It feels good yourself, you confirm it through your own experience, and praised by the wise. The next thing is he asks you to, he points out that you have choices to make about things that you cannot be utterly sure about. One of the problems of being existing is that you're going to have to make choices in your life, and the evidence is not going to be complete. You're not going to know ahead of time what the right answer is. You know, that's the way it is with exams and stuff. You can't have the answer sheet ahead of time. You kind of go in. You have to make this kind of decision happens all the time. Like, for instance, we had to make a decision about buying a new monastery. That was an interesting case. What the situation is, the weirdness of buying a new monastery is it's a monastery is a very unusual, especially a Buddhist monastery, a very unusual thing in this society, and there are no special building codes or classifications for Buddhist monasteries. So you're not too sure what the powers that be will finally do. You have to buy the thing first and then find out whether you can live there or not. This is the part of the zoning complexities of zoning and so forth. You have to, in order to get approval of being able to go ahead and do all of these things, you have to own the place first before you can. Because it's a process that takes months, and it has to go back and forth, and you can do this, and you can do that, and you might fit into this classification, but we could change it, but it's not for sure. It will be months before we can actually say anything for sure about the matter. In the meantime, you've got to lay the money down. You've got to commit yourself to this. You've got to buy the place before they're going to take any of your inquiries seriously, because they won't respond to an inquiry if you don't own the property. Why would they? You know, it's not like they're there to answer theoretical questions all day long. Got to own the property first. But you don't know whether to buy the place because you don't know whether it will be approved. So they put you in a terrible situation. All the risk is on you. So we discovered at the zoning that our idea was that we wanted to buy a piece of land where you could have a building, a kind of a service building, and then a meditation hall, and then everybody else would be in these little cabins dotted across the land, you see, instead of in a central building. But there are no models for this, and when we talked to the zoning board, they said, well, perhaps if we can rezone the property religious zoning, then there is a sort of an idea that you can honor the particular tradition that you're in how they do things. But normally speaking, we tend to think in terms of everybody living in a big building together. And so we're not sure that we could approve that. So that we're left with, okay, we could buy land, and have a kind of service building and everything, and then, but only later on, what if we find out that we can't have all of these little cabins dotted around? Then the whole vision is changed. Then we would have to build a great big building and so forth. So it turned out to be a lot of kind of bets. We had to make some choices where we would sort of cover both sides of things. So what we decided to do is buy a place with a great big building on it that had accommodation for quite a few people, not everybody that we, not the whole totality, not all 30 people. We wanted to have a place for 30 people, but that about 18 could be in this building. So, and then we could go from there, so that we tried to cover both sides, so that if they turned it down, that you could have all of these kutis, well, you already had this big building that people could live in, and you could do it that way. But on the other hand, if they did give permission that you could live outside the building, you wouldn't have put so much into this building that you didn't have anything left to do whatever you want. So we kind of had to make a decision based on certain unknown factors, but cover the most of the appropriate bets. And so that is, you're faced with that kind of situation in many times in life. This is the one of the propositions the Buddha talks about for the next life as well. You know, the results of your actions. That's what he's proposing, that maybe you cannot perceive the you're not sure about the totality of the workings of karma, but or whether there is a next life, etc. So he proposes that you have a bet to make in terms of this. He says that if you bet again, and this is similar to something in the West, this notion came up. I think it was 17th century. There was the idea of the bet on the nature whether God existed. The idea that you should bet in favor of that God exists because you have nothing to lose. However, this is not quite the same bet. But the bet idea was proposed by the Buddha 25 centuries ago. You don't see it emerging, that line of argument, in the West until about the 17th or 18th century. So the bet is, this is again to the Kalamas. These people do not have confidence ahead of time. He says, okay, you got a choice here. You're either going to die, you know, be annihilated, or not. So let's get the choices clear. Let's just get the scenario clear. You got two choices. Are you with me here? You either die or you don't. Yeah. Any third choices there? Sort of half die and you have. He says, let's say, what's the profit? What's the profit of assuming that when you die, that's it? Oh, why would you assume that? What's the evidence for that? Why would you? And how could you demonstrate that? How could you know that? He said, if you, let's say, since there is no clear, strong evidence for this, and there are all kinds of reports that people see the results of people after death, etc., what would be the profit of betting on that? Let's say that you bet that after this life, everything was finished, it was over. The profit of betting on that would be nil, because if it was incorrect, you would experience the fact that you were wrong. And of course, this is this would be a grave error on your part. Just a joke, grave. This would be a very bad mistake to have made. You would have lived your whole life presuming that when you die, that's it, and it turned out to be wrong. However, what if you were right? That when you die, that's it. Would it be a triumph on your part? Unfortunately, you would never know it. How could you know it? You're dead. Mm-hmm. You couldn't know, you couldn't have any experience of ever being right. So if you bet on that, you'll never know if you were right, and you'll only know that you were wrong. That's the only possibility, right? You couldn't know that you were right, and you could only find out that you were wrong. However, if you bet the other way, you can only find out that you were right, and you can never find out that you were wrong. Is that right? In other words, if you're annihilated at death, you could never experience that. You can never find out. If you bet that you aren't annihilated at death, you could only find out that you were right, that you aren't annihilated at death. That's the only possible thing you could find out. If you are annihilated at death, you would never be able to know that you were wrong in the matter. You say, I believe that I'm going to persist after death. Could you ever find out that you're wrong in that matter? No, it's impossible to find out that you're wrong. So which bet are you going to lay down? The one where you can only find out that you were right and never find out that you're wrong, or the one that you can never find out that you were right and only find out that you were wrong? And so you've got, this is a situation, if you don't know and can't know ahead of time. Now he's saying that it's not that it's impossible to know. It is possible. Some people know, have direct knowledge of this through extra normal type of faculties. But not everybody does. And the person who doesn't, and who is not clear about this, or doesn't have a lot of conviction about the matter, has to sort this out. They're in a situation where they do have to make choices. You are making a choice all the time. Even if you take the position where I don't know, so-called agnostic position, I don't know, you will only find out, you can only find out that that you continue to exist, right? You can never find out the opposite. Your not knowing can only be dispelled in terms of the positive. It can never be dispelled in terms of the negative. In the meantime, if you have a conviction about this matter, now you've got three possibilities. Conviction that I continue, conviction that I end, and conviction that I don't know, I'm not certain. In either case, it will influence all your actions. A person who has the feeling that they end has this, at some level of their mind, their conscious level of the mind, they think there's no consequence of what they do. In fact, for instance, let's say that you get, life becomes rather uncomfortable at a certain point. Now, if you believe in annihilation, you're going to think, well, I think I'll just put myself out of my suffering here. So you would be inclined to do something like that, or another person, I'll put them out of their suffering. What if this turns out that you're not putting either of you out of your suffering? You have gambled heavily on annihilation. And now an ethical choice is being made. And you're gambling heavily on this one. The one that you can't ever find out that you're right about. The one that you could only find out that you're wrong about. So this is influencing what you will do and your attitude in this life. If, on the other hand, you gamble heavily on the continuation thing, it may occur to you, well, just by terminating this life doesn't necessarily end suffering. Mine or anybody else's. And there could be unwholesome consequences of that as well. As well as all kinds of other things. So it tends to eliminate completely the possibility of consequences to your actions. The idea of annihilation. It eliminates that possibility. You may not be a bad person. You still may act, you may have some justification for acting in a restrained way. You say, well, it feels good to do this, feels good to do that. However, the whole understructure of concern for consequences is undercut. So there'd be a weakening of the tendency for restraint. On the other hand, if you do have at least the option that there is continuation, there certainly then is the possibility, and this is the other part of the argument, that there are consequences to your actions. But it matters. The other part of how holding strongly annihilationist view is that at some level at the pit of your stomach, it's hard to live with the utter inconsequentiality of everything that people do, that it's absurd. In other words, it doesn't mean anything, it doesn't go anything, it just gets annihilated. It doesn't go anywhere. It's only whatever happens for the moment. And that absurdity is hard to live with. A sense of it, it produces a dizziness, an unsettled feeling in the soul. Of course, if you have a strong annihilationist view, you don't have a soul, but nevertheless you feel there's a certain kind of existential queasiness that this produces. On the other hand, so in a sense there's no real benefit from holding this, not even if it was true. Let's take what if it was true? And you think, I just want to know the truth. I don't care. See, I don't care. Your argument is that it's not beneficial, but I don't care if it benefits me. I want to know the truth. I'm going to hold the truth. But I would say, well, why do you care about the truth if there's no consequences to anything? Why do you think that you're going to get brownie points because you told the truth? There's no consequence to anything, why would you care? Why do you care? When you really examine it, the only idea of meaning and caring about the nature of truth is if there are consequences to the concern for truth. I'd say that if it was the case, annihilation was the case, was true, and you came to that firm conclusion, you'd be better off denying it even to yourself. Because there's no consequences to it, right? You can choose to think anything you want. You can believe absolutely false thing. It just eliminates the value of truth. It makes it irrelevant. The only value that you would have then is how you feel. Certainly the thing, the area you want to choose in this terms of, well, why not at least choose to feel well? Choose something that makes you feel optimistic, healthy, well. There's no percentage in the nihilationist bet. It doesn't make you feel better. There's no triumph of being right. You can only find out that you're wrong, and it's impossible to ever prove. How can you ever demonstrate a negative? How can you ever demonstrate that things cease? It's impossible. That's the classic problem in logic. How do you demonstrate a negative? Let's say that you claim that that's why you can never say that there is no God in the universe. The Buddha carefully avoids that argument. He never authoritatively says that. He says because you can't, you know, you never know. There's might be. Have you searched the whole universe? Are you sure you got into every corner of it? You know, to prove that there is not. Something is absent is impossible. You can prove something is present. You can say, oh, here it is right here. But to prove an absence is a very difficult thing. The best you can do is say, it's not here. When you're looking for something, and say you dropped a pin or something in the room here, and you're looking around, oh, it's not here, not here, not here, not here. But when I say it's not here, it doesn't exist. Say, well, how can you say that? Well, the best you can say is that it's not here, and it's not there, and it's not there, and it's not there. You can keep on saying that, but you can never make the final statement that it doesn't exist. So the idea of committing yourself to a belief like annihilation very preposterous. It's impossible to demonstrate, prove. It has no benefits, has no advantages, and it makes truth itself irrelevant. So he's just pointing out all of these things. He's not advocating that one do either of these things. He always leaves it up to the karamas who are listening to him to make the judgment themselves. He doesn't say, I'm just outlining how you might think about these things. So there are two elements to consideration of the things that are difficult to know. That is, the first thing is consequence to actions. Secondly, that there is some something that persists after death. And they're tightly hooked up. And again, he says, what is the advantage of betting that there are no consequences to your action, that life is not causal? If you're wrong about this, you will be very sorry. Because you will tend to do things that are sort of immediately pleasurable, but may have consequences in the long run. That is exactly what happened. That it tends to be the mentality of a person who has no capacity to deny gratification, whereas they act on impulse immediately, and then don't concern themselves with consequences. Then later on, they're very sorry. Consequences occur. So there is no profit in betting that everything is inconsequential. Because if it turns out you're wrong, it would be a grave error, a very bad error. On the other hand, if you bet that there are consequences, karmic resultants, cause and effect in the universe, if you're right, you will be very happy because you have deduced the law of the universe, one of the laws of the universe. And to know how the universe operates gives you power. It gives you, you can direct yourself towards happiness. If you feel that the consequences of things should be in line with the initial action of them. So a good intention should have a good result. Bad, unskillful intention should have a bad result. If that's your conclusion about the nature of how the laws work and you're correct, you will have a huge amount of capacity to navigate in the universe. It'll be like being on a sailboat and understanding there's about four or five things on a sailboat that allow you to navigate. You can't just use the tiller, because if the sails are set in a certain way, you'll go around and no matter, just even if you hold on just to the tiller but you forget about the sails, you won't be able to get anywhere. You'll go in circles. If you forget about the tiller and you just manipulate the sails, you'll go in circles again, or wiggle and waggle. If you adjust both the sails and the tiller, now you're starting to be able to have some capacity to go somewhere, to navigate. There's still a few things left that you got to know. There's still currents. So even if the wind is behind you and you're holding the tiller straight, and the sails are spread out and you're sailing gloriously right in front of the wind, it's pushing you straight from behind, and you want to go through this kind of a narrows. If the tide is coming in, the current is faster than your boat will go, you'll go backwards. If you've never sailed, it's quite an experience. You can be sailing along going backwards, because the current in the ocean, when the tide comes in through it narrows, is like a river, and it just pulls you backwards. It's like trying to sail up a river. You can, if the wind is strong enough, and your sails are set right, and it's coming from behind you, and you have the tiller, you can sail up a river against the current. But if the current is running, say, at 10 knots or 12 knots, you'll go backwards down the river. So there are a few, there's about a complex of three or four major factors that allow you to navigate. And once you know all of them, you go well. You go really well. And this is, if you don't, if you presume that there is no navigation, you wake up in existence on this boat that is aimlessly wandering around. You see other boats out there, just going here and going there. You don't. And some people claim that they can go where they want to. And you don't believe it. All you see is like the sails, wherever the wind goes, the sails are loose, the tiller is loose, you're just standing there on the thing. It's just kind of going in circles. Sometimes it blows up on a beach. Sometimes it randomly goes here, goes there. You've never deduced that there's any principle behind this. You have no consequence. That's the feeling of the chaos of life. A person has no conviction of causality in life. They get onto a sailboat, and it just drifts. the current carries it this way, the wind carries it that way, the tiller gets loopy and it goes in circles. And if, so they're un, if they're not open to the idea that, you know, if you get a few of these things, if you understand a few of these principles, that you can actually direct this thing. All the profit would be towards the person who takes the bet that, that you can actually direct it, that there are causal factors. They're a little bit on the complex side. There's more than one. But the benefit will be to the person who undertakes that. If they're wrong, of course, well, you have nothing to lose. You just so if it turns out that everything is chaotically spinning through there, at least you enjoy the feeling of your presumption that you're in control. That there is some that you can direct your life. And if it's all chaotic, what have you lost? What would be the loss? Would be some no consequence to having. If there are no consequences, there's no consequences. So having bet on the bet that there is consequences, if you're wrong, there's no consequence. If it turns out the opposite way, if there are consequences to what you do, and you bet that there are consequences, you will have made a wonderful bet. If you have bet the opposite way, that there are no consequences, and there are, then you will have made a very poor bet. So those are the two. Those are the two areas that the Buddha talks to people who have not settled on any notions yet. There are mixtures of these philosophies where part of the of your life is the consequences of your life have to do with your own actions, and part of it is fortuitous, mysterious, or an intervention by God in a mysterious way for no particular fathomable reason. And it could be 90% your actions and then 10% kind of mysterious, unknowable intervention. Or it could be 1% your actions and 99% mysterious. There's all kinds of spectrum of view like that. But from the, in terms of the historical Buddhist teaching, everything is causal. That nothing is outside of these laws. There isn't anything outside of these laws. That's his bet. That's his conviction. That's his commitment. He says that's the way I view it, and that's the way my results are that I have ceased from suffering. I have a blissful experience. You can do this. And then I give a method to others, and they also have been able to do this. So he says it's experiential. You can confirm this in your own existence if you undertake this. Yeah.
For those who are doubtful about rebirth, could you not make an argument that there is some evidence that there is rebirth through, I think it was Dr. Stevenson, Ian Stevenson, did some studies where he, like for instance, he would talk to a 9-year-old girl. And she would say, well, I used to live in such and such house and such neighborhood, and this person with my husband, and could you not present to them that?
Yeah. That's another area, trying to demonstrate, you know, actual, the proof of these things. What he first presents is that that two beliefs are profitable and have no negative consequence, first. Belief that you continue after death. Secondly, that there are consequences to action. You can only find out that you were right. You can never find out that you're wrong. And there are two beliefs that are unwise bets: that you are annihilated, and that there are no consequences to action. You can only find out that you were wrong. You can never find out that you were right. And if you find out that you were right, there's no profit to it.
You're speaking about you continuing after death. What is the you?
Mm-hmm. Well, some sort of in the same sense as he would point out. You don't have to imagine it's any different than in this life. In the same sense, identity in this life, you are not the 10-year-old that you once were, but you're not other than the 10-year-old that you once were. There are influences. And of course, let's say it's an interesting area to just consider. We say, well, I can't remember my past lives. Why should I worry about my future lives? Well, in this life, let's say the situation comes up where you have a blood clot in the brain. And in order, maybe you or your child or your husband or something like this, and you have to decide. Now, the neurologist tells you that, well, if you don't get this treated, you're going to die. However, if we do take this out, you are going to lose your memory. You're not going to remember who you are. Which do you want to do? So you say, well, I'd rather live without the memory. So now what will you be doing? He says, now the operation is going to take place in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, you have time to make a preparation. What are you going to do? You're not going to remember who you are in 2 weeks' time. You're going to have no trace of the memory. Are you going to just not? What would you do? I would go around and talk to my friends and say, and put it in writing. I'd have a very, very clear living will. This is an interesting, weird kind of experience. You've got to make a will for yourself while you're alive. To what people are going to do with you while you're alive. And you're going to have very detailed preferences about how you're going to be treated. Do you want them to take away all your money? Huh? Do you want them to abandon you on the street? No, you want them to, you're obligated to, you're going to have to sign these things ahead of time. You're going to, I want this kind of care, I want to be kept at a certain standard, and I want my resources, I want to have veto power on any decisions made, I want this, I want that. Interesting how interested you are in this future identity that you will have no sense of being connected to. You won't recall your past life, you won't remember who your wife is, who your husband is, your friends, your child. You won't remember that. And yet you're trying to guarantee that structure. You're very concerned with what'll happen to you, aren't you? I think maybe some people wouldn't be. People who tend to live chaotically, they wouldn't have the, they couldn't make, they're not concerned with themselves tomorrow. In other words, they have no compassion for themselves in the future, tomorrow. So they do stupid things today and think, well, somebody else will have to get the rap. I enjoy myself today. Myself, as a day older, will get all the consequences. Of course, the self as the day older curses the one who did this yesterday. You idiot, you know, how could you do this? You're more or less in a relationship as if your younger brother were, you're paying the debts that your younger brother incurred. I had a friend who ran up, one day he went on a little $10,000 credit card rampage and then realized what he'd done. But of course, it's too late, and you're paying 18% on your $10,000 credit card rampage. And then I, you know, it was a couple of years, and he just couldn't pay it back. And I said, well, you got to think it like. He said, I want to not have the debt. I want to just declare bankruptcy. And I, well, you have to undertake it, and you have to think. Well, my younger brother went on a credit card rampage, and I have to bear the consequence of my younger brother's actions. That, in a sense, is what you're doing from your past mistakes. A younger and more foolish person did things, maybe even got married, and you get the result. The older, wiser person gets the result of this younger person's foolish decisions. Nevertheless, we call it ourself. We say, you know, if I said, if you go walk around and say, yeah, well, my younger sister got married and I got to put up with the lout, you know. I inherited her husband. She was very foolish. She didn't understand what she was doing, but she was very impulsive. I mean, if you start talking to your friends like this, it's, wow, that's a weird situation to be in. You got to put up with your younger sister's husband? And she was, where's she now? She run off with somebody else? No. Oh, she's not around. You know, she just did it and then vanished, you know, and left me with this mess, you know. Well, that is the situation you're really in. Why do you always say it's me that did this? It's not you. It was some foolish 20-year-old, 18-year-old that did this and left you holding the stew. You know? I hope nobody's husband's name is Stu. we should start thinking this way. You know, it's not us. We didn't. On the other hand, we also have debts of gratitude. The poor, sweaty little undergraduate student that went without. And then you get the 50 grand a year job. They put up with the poverty, the austerity. Your younger sister, you say, you know, that's a nice job you got. You say, yeah, my younger sister went to school, had to go without some meals and studied late into the night so that I could have a $50,000 a year job. Thanks, kid. I'm so glad you had such loyalty and consideration for your older sister. And in fact, that is the situation. That's the one who suffered back then. It's not the one who's enjoying the results, is it? Sometimes you have to that delay gratification. And you're not really the one that's going to get the reward. It's going to be your older sister, you know, you in the future. This 35-year-old is going to be sitting getting all the gravy out of this. And you are in that horrible experience of undergraduate life at university or whatever. I mean, some people like it. But so it works both ways. Either, you know, you can live carelessly concerning your who you're going to be 10 years from now, or you can live considerately. You can suffer now in order to experience profit later, or you can live frivolously, carelessly, in pleasure now and then suffer later. But you can't disconnect from your concern for that future being. It would be kind of pathological, and it is. Lots of people are. They exactly what they do. They live for the day, and they have such a mess later on. And this is disconnection from the continuity. There's no identity, but there is a continuity between the present and the future, and the past and the present. So the wise person recognizes the continuity and does things that are beneficial. So not only do we have to think 20 years down the road what job we're going to be in, but we have to think next lifetime down the road. We set up the causes for happiness right now. And it's not always all that easy. But we know that we have the wise intuition that there is causality and that we will benefit. These things will produce a beautiful fruit, you know, the fruit of your results. Yeah. Okay, where we go in question time is if the sun's in your eyes, by all means move forward and get out of the sun there. No problem. No need to stay at the back there. Question. Please explain, again, in brackets, how to do walking meditation and what to do with the mind. Why do we do it? What is its origin? Yeah, walking meditation is really a very vital part of the practice, especially monastic practice. In the forest tradition, it's every monk, every cave, every kuti, every tree that one sits under, the first thing one looks for is a walking meditation path. It's just integral to the way of life of monks. If you ever read suttas where the monks go off into the forest and meditate, you might have this idea that they just sat under a tree all day long and all night long, and maybe they lay down for some time, but you'd think, wow, that was the picture I had in my mind. I remember even when I was in my hermitage, the notion, because there are some schools of practice, and you might have even started in some, where the emphasis is not so much on walking meditation. Some of the Zen schools, for instance, if you go to a Zen retreat, there may be only 5 minutes walking meditation between sittings, and that'll be a kind of a group walking meditation, maybe in a circle. It'll be more or less to stretch the legs, and then you sit right back down. That might go, you might sit three sittings in a row and just two little 5 minute walking, and then very little concern with walking meditation. And then there'd be, instead of that, there would be some sort of work periods where you'd work for a couple hours and so forth. But in the in the forest tradition, where monks are actually living in the forest, and they are not doing manual labor, you know, monks don't raise gardens or things like that, it's integral to the way of life to spend a good deal of time in walking meditation. And I guess each monk evolves his own style, but basically it's very naturalistic. The reason why it's in a certain way, it may not even occur to the monks that are doing it why it is that way. They may just have learned it from their teacher and just presume that the path is about 50 feet long and that you walk back and forth, etc. But you know, all you have to do is think about the origins of it. The origin of a walking meditation in the Buddhist context is explained very well. Not in the suttas. You won't find it in the suttas. You'll find references to walking meditation in the discourses by the Buddha. One walks up and down, etc. He walks up and down. Moggallana was walking up and down at night. That's all they say. Where you find it explained is in the Vinaya, the rules of discipline for the monks, where it was, where they talk about the origins of all of these things. And it was simply to alleviate discomfort from heavy meals. That was one of the things they asked the Buddha. Actually, the Buddha's physician, Jivaka, asked the Buddha if it would be all right if the monks did walking meditation, because he thought it would be good for them after these meals. Some areas where you're eating only once a day, you might get a rather heavy meal, and the monks were not experiencing good health, so he recommended walking meditation. So, I mean, it's a very simple thing. It was actually for shrugging off the drowsiness that comes after a meal, a major meal, especially if you're only eating once a day, and to stretch your legs and keep in shape for walking. Remember that everybody walked. The monks especially weren't permitted to ride in vehicles. So if you had to go on on a tour, and it might be a teaching tour, you might have to walk 100 miles or so. So it keeps you in shape. Very pragmatic, not very mystical kind of origins of walking meditation. We have in the suttas, most of you have read the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutta, the Satipatthana Sutta. There you have, in the section on meditation on the body, you have when a monk is walking, he knows he's walking. That's all it says. That is it for the technical description of walking meditation. Monk knows he's walking when he walks. Nothing special. He knows that when he bends over, he's bending over. When he's stretching his arm, he's stretching his arm. He just knows this. He's aware of it. he's mindful to that degree. So there are no technical instructions anywhere in the whole, all of the suttas, anything that Buddha ever said, and in the Vinaya. But the reason why it comes down to restricted areas is that, you know, in the tropics it gets dark at 6 o'clock, and in those days you were lucky to have a candle. In fact, even when I was in Thailand, in the forest monasteries, sometimes you're lucky to have a candle to illuminate. And at 6 o'clock, what are you going to do? Go to bed? You know, it's dark. You might have been sitting for a long time, and you're in a tiny little hut. You have to get up and stretch your legs, especially if you're feeling sleepy. And since you get up at 2 or 3 in the morning, you're going to feel a little drowsy about that time. It's the Buddha's instruction is during the third watch of the day, or rather the first watch of the evening. They divide it into watches. 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. is the first watch, a 4-hour period, and then 10 to 2 and 2 a.m. Then 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. They divide it into the night into 3 watches. During that watch, one sits and walks up and down in order to shrug off drowsiness and to stretch the legs, exercise the body, and remain in continuous clarity. So that's a time of darkness, and especially if you're living in the forest, you're not going to go wandering around in the forest at that time. You're just going to want a restricted area that you can illuminate. So the idea of this about 50 feet the idea of the walking path developed and just a very linear kind of thing. Of course, it's very good. They discovered very quickly that it's nice to not have to watch too much where you're walking and, you know, on too rough ground. So in all of the monasteries, you'll have a very nicely graded kind of walking path, and that you don't have to watch whether you stub your toe or fall off the end of something. And just long enough to illuminate it at each end with a candle. So that's kind of the restriction on that. These days, I mean, we have electric light if you illuminate, and of course in Edmonton it's light till 11 or so. So you don't need that. You could, theoretically, if you're outside, have a longer area for walking. There's nothing really, no particular reason. Although it's very nice to that the mind doesn't get into where it's any kind of a journey. That's nice. That's a different feeling, that you're going somewhere and sort of looking around, going for a walk. A different feeling going for a walk than being on the meditation path. The mind is very rested when it needs to only walk up and down and there isn't any place to go. This idea of pacing used to be kind of common. If you read 19th century novels or descriptions, even in England, the idea of pacing up and down in the living room, you know, no TVs, you know. The idea of pacing in the drawing room, people pacing back and forth, not an uncommon description. Very, very restful, very peaceful to just get up and pace. Very natural. So it's I guess the optimal posture for meditation is sitting, because the least conditional. There's no movement. You don't have to watch where you're going. You can shut down the senses and you can go into the mind alone. Just observe one sense, the mind sense. With walking, you're having to keep your eyes open, so you're more in the sensory world. And you may find it, some people find it very, very difficult. Indeed, their mind tends to really proliferate and wander when they do walking meditation. But the Buddha does say that concentration And you can develop, this is a question asked me in Ottawa, can you develop concentration, real samadhi, while walking? You can. The Buddha praises the development of concentration while walking. Concentration developed while walking is very strong, and it lasts a long time. It has a tendency to persist. The reason why? That there's more conditions to deal with, and so if you're able to really focus while walking, it will be a greater depth of concentration than you might get with sitting, because you're not really you have optimal conditions while sitting. So that one shouldn't discount the possibility of attaining a very focused kind of mind state while walking, and that one should expect that it will be of strong, and you'll be. It indicates that you won't be easily distracted. The advice for the monk who attains some degree of concentration in meditation, and one of the effects of concentration is that you will experience the sign of concentration. That is, you will, certain characteristic experiences will be there, and one of them is lightness of body, restraint of mind, that the mind will be extremely centered, and you have an enormous sense of clarity of mind, and very light, energetic experience, and the mind will obviously be very still and quiet. This is the sign that you are either on the edge of concentration or in concentration. So the advice is now, but one of the things the monk has to do every day is he has to go into the village on alms round. So this is a great opportunity for losing your concentration, especially for a Western monk in a little Thai village somewhere. It's a fascinating experience. It's hard to restrain the senses. You really want to look at what's going on. It's so fascinating. But you guard the sign. The idea of going on walking meditation, in walking, is to guard the sign. If you get the sign of concentration, the lightness of body, the stillness of mind, the focus, the peace that comes from that, then you're to guard the sign while walking. And that involves sense restraint. So you can lose the sign of concentration by too much interest in the sensory, like to look around with the eyes, to become interested in sounds. This, you will find a diminution of the sign, concentration. So your idea is to guard that sign. Don't let it slip away. If you do find yourself experiencing a sense of real sense of well-being, lightness of body, clarity of mind, illumination of mind, stillness, something would be called stillness, a silence of mind in the sense of the chatter and so forth has subsided, then to be very careful not to disturb that in your meditation when you get up to walk. Guard that sign. Keep it with you. You can maintain it in walking meditation. So you can stay right on the edge of a very profound state of concentration even while walking. It's very blissful. I could say more about this, and maybe I'm sure I will probably during the retreat, this guarding the sign idea and so forth, and what are signs, but that gives you an idea. Well, there was some other thing about this. What to do with the mind? Just keep the mind. I would say the key word might be stillness of mind, lightness of body. While walking, stillness of mind, lightness of body. Feel how light the body is induce this sense to float across the room, to light, not to float, but to lightly walk across the room. And don't over-concentrate. There's nothing special about this. You're just walking across the room. Don't try to make anything more of it than that. Now, there are techniques. There are techniques for slowing down. And you can. They're also legitimate. Now, this is classical of the Burmese school of slow walking meditation, where you're dividing each movement of the step, etc., into 5, 6 parts, 4 parts, 3 parts. This is very good. It actually very slows you down. You're doing something which you're able to do without thinking, but you're now doing it in an abnormal way, so you're having to pay great attention to this. If you find that your mind is running around, you may actually want to do that, the slow motion type, dividing the steps up. It is, especially if you're coming out of the world, you want the mind to settle down. It's quite often it's a fairly rich experience for the mind to anchor itself in. So you might find that. But it's not totally necessary. If you find that the mind is reasonably there, you can just walk in a fairly natural way, and not asking the mind, you can make the mind restless by making too many demands on it, by asking it to find something special in this fact that you're walking across the room. It will make it restless. The Buddha is just very natural. You just want to know that you're walking across the room. You want to keep this in mind. That's all you're doing. See how simple this thing can be. Or it's so simple that the mind has trouble with it. It's so simple. How simple can you get? Just you realize, I'm going to have to be very simple to simply walk across this room and nothing more. Now, I don't want to make too much of it. I don't want to make anything special of it. And at the same time, I don't want to think there's so little to it that I better amuse myself with a story. What a very interesting thing to find the balance, the simple act of walking across the room. And that reason why the Buddha says only this, that when walking, one knows one is walking, when stretching one's arm out, one knows one's stretching one's arm out, etc. And at the end of that passage, and you're to do this mindfully, with mindfulness and clear comprehension. There are whole societies now devoted to, with the word mindful, they're mindfulness societies, mindfulness groups. It's been extracted from Buddhist practice, but there's another little word that's hyphenated that follows that, and it's almost never found alone. The original word for mindfulness is sati, S-A-T-I, the idea of mindfulness. But there's always a little hyphen after it, and there's another word that goes with it. It's called sampajanya, which we've translated as clear comprehension. Mindful and clearly comprehending of what you're doing and why you're doing it. The why you're doing this is always there too. You're not simply being mindful. You understand why you're being mindful. Just the extent necessary for overcoming covetousness and grief for the world. This is another revelation. If you read this very simple sutta, it's very good to pay attention to each of the words. How mindful do you want to be? You want to be mindful just to the extent necessary to know that you're walking across the room and why you're doing this. You're doing this first for the training of attention, the training of the capacity to pay attention, sustained attention, and to perhaps pay attention to one characteristic, that is the impermanence of the experience as you're walking across the room. That's clear comprehension. That is to know the meditator's domain. This is the domain which you are to remain in. In other words, the field that you're to stay in. The knowledge that you're walking across the room and the paying attention of the impermanent nature of it. And to the extent necessary for overcoming covetousness and grief for the world, that that's a very British way of translating something, but it just means covetousness is you want something, and grief is you don't want it. Some sort of problem with the world, or some sort of desire for the world. Just to the extent necessary for the subsiding of that. So you're actually doing, you're also checking in on your emotions here. Are you having trouble with anything in terms of your relationship to the world? Or are you craving something? You know, you're waiting, hoping that as soon as this walking meditation is over, then the lunch bill's going to go. And I'm going to have some, and it was really delicious yesterday, but I must get more of that pudding. You know, this is covetousness. Or, you know, I'm so bored, you know, it's just like, so it's such a dry exercise. I can't wait for this to be over so I can get back to the sitting where I really enjoy it. Grief. Covetousness and grief. Just be aware. Those are the first, this is the shorthand way of saying the five hindrances. And normally, they don't want to enumerate it. They want this, the delivery of that sutta is, there's a huge amount of material delivered. The Buddha doesn't want to go into excess detail, but he, and he's talking to experienced meditators and addressing monks, and he's giving a whole long list. And as a good teacher does, they don't get carried away with too much pedantic detail if they want to communicate with the students, and they're addressing it to that level. So they just, he just says shorthand, covetousness and grief. They know that means all of the five hindrances. So one of the things you're to note is that the part of this function of mindfulness is that you're truly mindful when the hindrances have subsided. So part of the reason why you're being mindful is to pay attention, looking for this characteristic of, say, impermanence. And you really won't see it, or you won't have the capacity to see it to any significant degree, unless the hindrances have subsided. So you can also ask yourself, what am I doing? I'm walking across the room. Do I know it? I know it. What's my goal? The goal can be to induce a sense of serenity, that is, lightness of body, clarity of mind. Am I doing that by paying attention, staying within the body? Am I successful at that? Now, can I reflect on the transient nature of the feelings that I'm experiencing? The touch of the foot on the floor, the feelings that flow through the body, the transience of that. That's a kind of an insight reflection on it. Are the hindrances absent? Or am I distracted, longing, etc.? That's part of walking meditation, to check, are the hindrances absent? Am I present? Am I just using it just as a domain, not to overstrain, not to make nothing more of it than to walk across the room, and not to make light of it, to think that I'm just stretching my legs and now I have time to sort of go off and think about things somewhere else, you know. Just somewhere in between that, just enough to keep the mind here, but not expecting it to be anything much more than that, not a mystical experience. In brief, only a half an hour, a little bit about walking meditation. I'll be talking about it more during the retreat, because it really should be talked about more. Often it's demonstrated, but there's a whole lot of lack of what sort of attitude you should bring to this experience. And that really needs to be, you need to be reminded of that. Again, from past retreats, or anybody who's been to past retreats, I show that there's a naturalistic way of walking across the room. Obviously, in a room this size, you're not going to run across the room. Outside, though, if you're really drowsy and you have a chance outside, you could actually walk fairly fast, briskly, for 60, 70 feet, and then turn around. Mark off the... make a mark where you're going to stop so you don't have to keep thinking, how far have I walked? This helps the mind as well. A leaf or a branch or a little indentation in the lawn, so you don't have to think too much about where you're walking. And as I say, if you're drowsy, walk a little faster. If you're agitated, walk a little faster. Also, to discharge excess energy, walk a little faster, and also when you're feeling sloth and torpor, walk a little faster. If you're feeling very, very concentrated, you will naturally tend to slow down and you'll be savoring the experience, and you're not going anywhere, and it feels very, very nice, so you tend to be enjoy the experience, and generally speaking, you tend to slow down. You can even just stand there. There's standing meditation, of course. One of the four postures is just to stand there. And that's entirely possible. Also, in your walking meditation inside, just come to the end of it and just close your eyes and stand there. Enjoy it. Just be there. That can be used for a couple of purposes, too. When the mind is really seriously absent, you can just stop. I'm not going anywhere until you come back here. It's like taking a 6-month-old dog for a walk in the park, Okay, we're not going on until you get here, settle down, or a kid, We're not going anywhere until you get back here, So just stand there, get the mind back there, get it settled, get oriented. It's nice to be in an environment like this where you can do this. You feel a little weird out in a park, a public park, just standing there with your eyes closed, but people wonder what you're doing. That's why, if you meditate out parks are not good places for meditating, the frisbee thing, and people, if you sit there with your eyes closed, people are wondering. But cemeteries are good places. If you got to meditate, go to a cemetery. And then everybody thinks, well, they must be some. They don't want to actually look at you, so you're allowed to do things like stand there with your eyes closed, or sit there with your eyes closed. Or walk back and forth also. You're allowed to be a little strange in cemeteries. And you're also allowed to be a little strange here. It's perfectly normal to be a little strange here. So it's a nice environment to do that. So feel free to just stand there with your eyes closed. And explore these things and find... This is the development of wisdom and personalization of your practice. Particularly in the Theravada forest tradition, it's known for a wide range of skillful means, and that individual monks practice in extremely different ways. Some monks will take a determination during the whole rainy season, say the 3 months that they spend in particular, during the rains, the 3 months that you determine to stay in one monastery, that's the time when you take on sort of special practices that you... And some monks will determine, well, they're going to do 8 hours of walking meditation every day. They really need to invest in their walking meditation. Not the sitting meditation is not so important. The other monk will determine not to walk more than 1 hour per day. Everything else is sitting. Other monk will determine not to lie down to sleep. He's been indulging in sleep a lot, and every time he lies down, it's an excuse to sleep. So he said, well, I'll sleep, but I'll just sit up to sleep so that I'm not diving into the comfort of sleep. So you could have a wide variety of possibilities here. Now everybody's different. Everybody needs different things. And so your walking meditation and how you do it will be different, but try to cultivate wisdom. Like, what would be good for me? If I got a weak point, what could I devise that would be aid me in this? Do I need to walk more briskly? Do I need to walk outside instead of inside? Do I get into the trees and flowers and birds too much out there? Maybe it's better to be in a place like this without windows. You know, it's much more you find it much more conducive to the mind staying on track. Different types of temperaments need different environments. Some do well in dark caves. Some need to be on the top of a mountain with a very spacious view. They feel very trapped and restless in confined places. So ask yourself a little bit about your how you do in different environments and try to explore it and find within the structure of the retreat optimal types of practices for yourself. This is really very important to cultivate that a wisdom to try and investigate why you do it, what's the benefit of this, how can it be used skillfully for my practice. I think we'll be having interviews also during the retreat, and you can reflect with me on some of these things, because sometimes you might cater to a hindrance and rationalize it. What I need to do is sleep a lot. And that might be true, but it's good to get a little feedback on these things sometimes, just to share that with somebody else, and they say, I don't think so. I think you need to stay awake more. And on the other hand, it might be fighting the fact that you want to sleep a lot, and you might get the feedback that says, I think you need to sleep, actually. I think you're really tired. Your battery's all burned out, you know. So maybe you have to rest a little bit. So it's sometimes good to get some interaction about that. Well, we'll move smoothly on, segue to the next question, which is, this is a question about the third hindrance, tinamida. Here's somebody who knows their Pali. They actually know the tinamida is usually translated as sloth and torpor. When in its darkest hour, I am totally at its mercy, unable to rouse even a small amount of energy to counteract it. Do you have any suggestion? P.S. Welcome back. Thank you. Tinamita is a real, it's a good one. You know, remember the simile for that one is like to be released from sloth and torpor is like being let out of bondage, to be in a dark little cell with chains on your wrists and feet. You are in chains. And exactly that. Just think, it's very good sometimes to think of what that as, you know, this has got me chained up, because quite often you will kind of cater to it, you will kind of surrender to it. Think how nice it would be to have to throw this thing off. It tends to convince you that you can't. But you dwell on the beautiful experience of being wide awake and full of energy. And it's just like being released from prison. Such a fresh, being alive again. Hold that out as a carrot to yourself, as a positive recollection. Think how lovely to be out of this prison cell, out in the open air. And that's exactly where you should be when you have tinamita, is out in the open air. Walk up and down, look at the sky also. Open your eyes wide and get some light in your eyes. Directly in your eyes, light. It's the kind of thing, it's not...